Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Are you ready for some football? Oh yeah, that immortal question asked by Hank Williams Jr. every Monday night for several decades. Well, it's Monday morning here at Research on Religion, and with the 2010 NFL playoffs in full swing, is there not a better time to reflect upon the role of religion in professional sports? I think not. Now, I do understand that some of our regular listeners may not be as big of NFL fans as I am. In fact, some of you might even think of that other sport when I say football. You know, what Americans call soccer. May God have mercy on their souls. And some of you folks might not be sports fans at all. I understand that. But please don't tune out just yet. The topic that we're going to be discussing today really deals with the difficulties that sudden fame and fortune can bring to individuals and how religion may help in stabilizing people in those situations. You know, oftentimes, and perhaps too often, sudden fame and fortune lead to a variety of behavioral problems, including drug and alcohol abuse, criminal behavior, and sexual problems. This not only applies to players in the NFL, but many professional and collegiate athletes who are under immense pressure to perform at superhuman levels and receive lavish praise for their efforts face similar issues when dealing with life in the spotlight. And the list doesn't stop with athletes. Think about famous musicians, movie stars, celebrated TV personalities, and even elected politicians. You know, the tabloids are filled with tales of people who seem to have it all yet end up squandering everything they have. I dare say even within my profession, academia, you hear similar stories of people who rise to the top quickly, only to discover the taste of fame is not always so sweet. So today we're going to examine how fortune and fame can disorient individuals and what role, if any, religion plays in stabilizing troubled lives. So I'm very excited to invite on our show our guest today. His name is Professor Eric Carter. Eric is an assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown College, and that's in Georgetown, Kentucky. And he's the author of Boys Gone Wild, Fame, Fortune, and Deviance Among Professional Football Players. Professor Carter earned his doctorate at Kansas State University, and while conducting his dissertation research, he had unprecedented access to over 100 professional football players between the years of 2001 and 2006. Eric, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me on today.
All right. Let me start off with a question that is somewhat becoming a standard question here on our podcast, and that is, what got you interested in this topic, studying deviance among NFL players?
Well, first, I probably ought to take a step back and just talk a little bit briefly about just, you know, growing up and my interest in football in general.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear that.
You know, I grew up an enormous Cleveland Browns fan.
Ooh, that's got to be tough.
And recent decades have proved to be very tough.
Yeah.
But, you know, growing up a football fan and a sports fan in general, I always had a pretty big interest in the activities and sports as kind of a social institution. And one of the things that I always thought about as I got older was, why in the world do we take this so seriously? You know, I would always reflect back to my days in the late 80s and watching the drive or the fumble that defeated the Browns in the AFC Championship game and remembering just how devastated I was as a kid. And I would think, why in the world do I care so much about that? And so as I got older and began to look for research projects in college and those kinds of things, I started to think about the power of sport and sport as an institution and why do people care so much? Why has this become a cultural phenomenon? Why are our athletes, why have they become, you know, demigods and mythic figures of sorts?
Yeah, they certainly are, especially for young boys. You know, the sports hero is really the role model that they look up to, the professional football players. And I can imagine that a lot of them feel this intense pressure to be role models. I'm thinking of Charles Barkley, famous, you know, quotation saying, listen, I just play basketball, I'm not a role model. But yeah, we definitely give heroic stature to some of these players.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's just thinking about how powerful sport has become in our culture. You know, I don't think, you know, that there's another institution in American society outside of perhaps religion that commands the same mystique and nostalgia and cultural attachment that sports does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's it's a pretty powerful thing. It's so powerful. I mean, I was thinking about the last Super Bowl that I was at was when Philadelphia played New England. And I'll never forget listening to all the Philadelphians that borrowed against their own homes to attend the Super Bowl.
Wow, you know,
that's
yeah.
a pretty powerful.
Absolutely. So you got a chance to go to Super Bowl too, huh?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I spent a week down there that year, and I've been to multiple games and around, you know, all of those the different venues of professional football over the last really 10 or 12 years. But that was an interesting week for sure. But it, you know, just the power of the game and as a cultural phenomenon has just become immense. You know, I mean, Monday Night Football is a cultural institution almost. Super Bowls, you know, 10 of the most watched programs of all time are Super Bowls. You know, those are things that are a pretty interesting thing. You know, Super Bowl is basically a national holiday.
Right.
But you know, that's the things that I was thinking about. You know, in terms of, you know, how I got started on this project, just initially was just my interest in sport and football in particular.
Now, did you play football at all?
Actually, I did not. I never did. I did as a kid, and you know, my first attempt at football, I broke my collarbone, and that Ooh. Was the end of it. So,
yeah, no, I played for a little bit in junior high and the beginnings of what we would consider high school here, and I was a horrible player on a horrible team within a horrible division, so you can imagine just how bad I am. But again, I love the sport, and I just have to mention here for all our listeners that, you know, my NFL fantasy football team has just won the championship in our division, so not that that's relevant or anything, but I think the whole world should hear that, and I guess that kind of it emphasizes, again, how much this sport, not only NFL, but other sports, basketball, baseball, that really can take a hold of us as a cultural institution.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that being the backdrop,
mm-hmm.
I had a couple friends that played in the NFL, and you know, having conversations with them over the last 15 years has really, really propelled me into this project. You know, I back in 97, I remember pretty distinctly my first conversation with a friend of mine, and you know, and this was well before I was thinking about any kind of project or research or anything like that. It was just us getting together to catch up and that kind of thing, and you know, I just listened to these stories of deviance, of kind of unlawless, you know, lawlessness, and you know, these kinds of things, and it was just, I just couldn't believe some of the stories I was hearing. Of course, I could believe them, but you know, the things that became more unbelievable were the fact that, you know, he was talking about guys that who had everything that were attempting suicide, who were miserable in their lives, and that kind of thing. And so I talked with him for a while, and then I met up with another guy later on who was another friend of mine, and that's when this project really began to take shape. I started spending a lot of time with him.
And so you're a graduate student at Kansas State University, and you approach your advisors and say, hey, this is what I want to be my dissertation topic. How do they respond to that?
Well, you know, the first response was not very good.
Yeah. Usually how it is with graduate student dissertations, but yeah.
But by that time, I had already collected a wealth of data because I'd been kind of hanging out with these guys for a long time, and I actually began this with my master's thesis, you know, in terms of beginning. It was a much smaller project,
right,
at that point in time. But so this has kind of been my side project up through my PhD program, and then I realized, you know what, I've got some good stuff here. This needs to be my dissertation.
Yeah, I guess there's a lesson in it too for graduate students. We have a number of graduate students who listen to us. Is even though your advisors might tell you one thing, you really have to kind of come to grips with what your passion is in academia, because you know, whenever you find a passion for it, you're going to do a good job and remain interested in what you're doing. So
yeah, that, you know, that's true, because if I had not went through with this project or gone through with this project, I probably wouldn't have the book right now, and I just wouldn't have been able to really get in depth with a lot of these guys. It allowed me more opportunity to spend time with them, and for a lot of my ideas to really come through and come out. So that was really important for the project, and not just for me, but just for them as well. Mm-hmm. You know, as respondents, I really cared about those guys because they were, first of all, two of them were really good friends of mine, and I just watched kind of the self-destruction to a certain degree to a couple of those guys and to others that I became very acquainted with and almost friends with as well. And so I really cared about them, and I cared about the NFL. You know, this project wasn't something that I set out to do as an indictment on the NFL, certainly, because I watch every Sunday. You know, we have the Sunday ticket. Watch the Browns lose every Sunday now. But, you know. Not every Sunday, almost.
Almost every Sunday, but speaking about doing this project, I want to, before we get into your findings, I want to kind of explore how you got to do this, because one of the things that most sports fans are going to tell you is really the sycophantic nature of the sports media. In order to get access to any of these guys in this cloistered society, to use a bit of religious lingo there, you have to guarantee the players that you're not going to ask any tough questions. And you know, not surprisingly, you tend to get a bunch of canned answers from the athletes that, you know, they're always showing the positive side of pro sports. You know, how'd you play today? Oh, I gave 110% on the field. I love my teammate and coaches, and, you know, I love working with the kids and doing community service projects, et cetera, et cetera. But that wasn't what you were asking. And so let me ask you this. How were you able to get this intimate access to over 100 NFL players?
Well, like I mentioned just a little bit ago, it really started with these two friends of mine, and they became basically my informants, if you will. And so through conversations with them and then spending time with them with other players and more of their peers at various places, whether it be training camps or just hanging out, you know, playing golf, playing basketball, going out to local establishments, the hangout spots, to those kinds of places. You know, gradually I began to develop relationships with these guys. And like I said, this really started back in 97. So, this, you know, the formal study that I had, you know, was much shorter. But, you know, this was a long process of establishing relationships with these guys. And it really came from these two informants who kind of went in and said, you know, this guy's okay. You know, he's one of my friends. He's doing a little project. You know, he's just interested in hanging out with us. You know, and I was very honest about what I was doing. But just by my presence constantly with a lot of those guys, they became very comfortable with me, and to a point also became, you know, they also kind of started to think of me as somebody who had some answers, you know, to a certain degree. And so they would kind of confide in me a little bit, you know, about what was going on in their lives and families and teams and with peers and players and those kinds of things. So it just took a long time, you know. It was about developing strong relationships, developing rapport with those guys, and letting them know that I wasn't there to sell them out.
Right.
You know, I wasn't a part of the media. I wasn't going to use their names. I wasn't going to, you know, give any indication about who they were, where they were from. You know, that I really did. This was an important project because they themselves began to see this as a way that might generate some answers to why they were feeling the way they were feeling, and why teams and organizations did what they did.
Yeah.
You know, why they as athletes felt like they were just commodities that were bought and sold on the marketplace, you know. And so that, you know, there's a whole kind of series of things that they became interested in through the course of this project. And I think that's what really made it work, was just spending enough time to get to know them and spend enough time to where I could actually ask good questions.
Yeah, no. <You know? laughs> Well, before we go into the details of what you did ask and the answers that you received from them, give us a general picture of what you aptly describe or title your book as, Boys Gone Wild. I mean, what is the extent and nature of social deviance in the NFL?
Well, you know, I thought about, you know, what this should be titled, and you know, I thought this was very, you know, for a nice catchy title, this might grab people's attention, but really the wild part was what's important in this, and the boys in the wild, because a lot of these guys, despite being grown men, you know, have been coddled and pushed through the system and their whole lives, and they've never really been given the opportunity to mature in certain ways. And the wild part, because of just the sheer nature of the, or the sheer extent of the deviant activities that goes on, that go on in the NFL, and as much as we hear in the media, you know, which is a lot, being here in Georgetown, which is close to Cincinnati, you can imagine all the things that we hear coming out over the last few years from the Bengals.
Right.
But what we hear is really a small portion of what goes on. You'd be surprised at how much is actually still covered up. That's how powerful the NFL is as an organization. So I was thinking about what really, you know, conceptually grabs this study, and I thought Boys Gone Wild makes a lot of sense because of the extent and nature of the social deviance that you see in the NFL. You know, there's been several studies done before, not, you know, where they've just gone in and looked at court data and that kind of thing. And a guy, Benedict and Yeager, back, I think it was in the late 90s, 98, I believe, wrote a book called Pros and Cons. And in that book, they established that there was about 1 in 5 players that had been charged of serious crimes or criminal offenses. And they conducted several studies after that, and it pretty much held steady that there was, you know, somewhere between 20 and 25% of NFL players that were involved in some kind of serious criminal activity. So there's kind of been established for a while that there's, you know, there's a pretty heavy existence of unlawful or deviant behavior in the league. And again, you know, unlawful are just those guys who are breaking the law, but the deviance extends far beyond that.
Yeah, give us some sense of that. What are some of the typical problems that these NFL players get involved in? I mean, we're just talking in general terms now, but are there certain patterns? Is the domestic violence? Is it robbery? What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of course, the nature of the game is violent. I mean,
right.
These guys are paid to hit each other and hurt each other. And so there is quite a bit of domestic violence. There's a lot of force. They use a lot of force on women. You know,
mm-hmm.
Women are typically conceptualized or categorized as sexual prey to those guys. This is probably the most, one of the more despicable kinds of things that goes on within the NFL in terms of kind of the culture of deviance, if you will, is just the violent nature and how they view women. And this is not, of course, I don't want to generalize to the whole population, certainly.
Right.
But, you know, there's quite a bit of that goes on, you know, just in their views of women. You know, and a lot of that's fueled by the money that they have, the power that they have, the status that they have in the community, and how they feel entitled. They feel entitled to whatever that it is that they want to do. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that, you know, I would be out with these guys, and you know they would have $6,000-$10,000 cash in their pocket, and blow through $10,000 in one night, you know, and on women, on liquor, on drugs, on what have you, and so a lot of these things are very connected, you know, obviously. So there was a lot of problems around those areas, kind of the substance abuse areas, which then fueled some of the domestic violence. To a certain degree, you know, there was a lot of guys were unhappy, and so therefore a lot of guys actually, you know, attempted to commit suicide, which is kind of a startling finding. You know, when you talk to these guys and they have about everything they need, and here they are so unhappy with their lives that they're willing to attempt to end it, their lives. So you know, there was a wide range, and again, I don't want to generalize to the whole population, because I'm talking about a group of 100 guys,
right?
You know, and that's what I had access to.
Yeah, and it's you know, for some of us, it really seems odd, and we see the stories in the newspaper. You know, so and so at the height of his career, you know, tries committing suicide, or even things these guys that you say are walking around with $10,000 of cash in their pocket. It get picked up for robbery, for stealing a pair of shoes or something along that lines. And so, you know, a lot of us working stiffs who might be, you know, moderately successful at what we do, and, you know, we earn a pretty decent income, we always dream of hitting it big, right? Winning the lottery, becoming a millionaire, being discovered by a prominent Hollywood agent, or, you know, for us in academia, writing that New York Times bestseller, or even, you know, starting as a tailback for the, you know, Dallas Cowboys or something like that. But, and then we look at these people who have accomplished what we dream of, and we see them complaining or getting into trouble, and we stop and tell ourselves, "Hey, come on, man, what's your problem? I know I could handle that if I was in their shoes." And so, but we constantly see the same story of fame and fortune leading to this miserable life. So what's going on here? You know, what do you get any sense from these guys? You ever have to say, "Hey, come on, man, you got it all. What's going on?"
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's really how I started with my second buddy, the guy that I'm really close with, and went to college where I went to college, and I told him that one day we met, first time that we really had a conversation, you know, when I was thinking about this project, and we met in a hotel in Cincinnati, and I said, "Man, what the heck is going on?"
Yeah.
I said, "Why don't you let me take a shot at this?"
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, it really is a pretty complex thing for these guys, and they don't really recognize what's going on. You know, things happen so fast for them,
mm-hmm.
especially in the era of free agency. You know, they go from college to the pros. So they go from being non-working college students, even though, you know, if they play in a big time, you know, BCS program now, they're coddled and they have some resources and some status, but that's nothing in comparison to what they get when they get to the NFL, when they sign that first contract, especially if they get a big signing bonus. So they go from not having a lot to having a ton immediately. You know, it's really, I mean, it's almost a violent shift in life. You know, it's something that is just, most of those guys have a hard time dealing with, particularly the guys that come from more humble backgrounds, guys that, you know, don't have a lot of social support in
right.
other places. You know, they come from single parent households. An overwhelming amount of these guys never knew who their father was, or if they did, he was either dead or in prison. You know, they very rarely saw their mothers or their grandmothers because they worked so many hours just to try to support the family. You know, they just had little community tie and family ties. So there was not a whole lot of stability for these guys. And so this shift, you know, this shift in status and fame and wealth particularly was hard for them to cope with,
mm-hmm.
You know, and all the things that come with that when you become a superstar in the NFL. And not even when you're a superstar necessarily, when you become an NFL player. Because in these cities, most people recognize you even if you're not Carson Palmer or, you know, Terrell Owens or whoever it might be, you know, Tony Romo.
Yeah. Well, in your book, you talk about this, and you use academic term here, and being that we're a podcast on research on religions, you know, turn a little bit more into the theoretical academic discussion here. You bring up this term called social anomy and describing what these guys are going through. So what is that term, social anomy?
Well, I took this from kind of Emile Durkheim, who was a sociologist and in the 19th century, and wrote a couple books where he used this concept, one the division of labor in society and the other suicide, where anomy became really an important concept in the sociological literature. So I kind of utilized his conception of it and tweaked it a little bit to kind of fit a more contemporary setting. But when I think about social anomy, I think about when life changes fast, people have a hard time coping. And what happens in that is there, with that life change, there becomes a conflict in the norms of these athletes' lives. You know, they basically, you know, fall into a state of normlessness, for example. And this normlessness, again, is brought about by sudden prosperity. And Durkheim kind of in Suicide talks about kind of the anomy of affluence, in a sense, or acute anomy. And this is, you know, the rapid shifting of lives. And he talks about it at a more macro level. But I would argue that when he's he was talking about it at a more macro level, because I think that that's the kind of data that he had. But theoretically, it seems to me, or at least my interpretation of anime, he talks about it at a more at a level of relationships, and so I see that playing out in these guys' lives. You know, just the idea that when life changes fast, regulatory impacts are weakened.
Yeah, let me stop you right there. I want to explore this concept of social anime a little bit more, because you make a really interesting distinction about what Durkheim was doing and what you're doing. And reading through your book, I think you really apply this quite well. I've come across the term social anime a few times in my own work, in people who've picked it up from Durkheim, looking at the very macro sense. And a lot of times it's talked about in terms of societies going through a modernization period, that there's rapid industrialization, or people are moving from the countryside into the city, the urbanization process, leading to social anime and people becoming very disoriented in this process. You're torn up from your traditional roots, your traditional moorings, and you're put into you leave the countryside and you move to the city, and it's very disorienting, and you're pulled in a lot of different directions. Now, when I did some research back in Latin America on this, a lot of people were talking about the growth of Protestantism in terms of this idea of social anime. And for me, that was always somewhat curious. So I come at this term with a little bit of skepticism here, because I saw the fact that people from the countryside would be ripped up from their social roots, and the idea was that, well, they were previously Catholic there, and they're put into the city, they all of a sudden become Protestants. So they move in a different direction. For me, I was always thinking, well, what about going back to their traditional roots, not necessarily in the countryside, but just seeking out the Catholic Church again? So for me, this term social anime, I don't know, what is going on, at least at the social level, I have problems with it. I think at the micro level you're doing, it's a pretty firm concept, because you're talking about people who didn't have these social moorings before and then are put into a different environment. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, I'm using the concept as a much more social psychological concept,
mm-hmm.
Because when I read Durkheim, I know he uses, you know, the macro, the shift and that kind of thing, you know, the shift into the division of labor and so on and so forth. But when he's in Suicide, when this concept really becomes a solid sociological concept, it seems to me that he theoretically is using it. Again, at the level of social relationships. So it's a much more micro level in terms of how he's theorizing about, you know, how the, you know, kind of the anomic drive for things, you know, and what that does to individual people, you know. And so to me it seems as if, you know, it's even for Durkheim, even though a lot of people would probably argue with me, it seems to me that it's probably a more social psychological concept if you look at it theoretically. Now, again, his data, though, the aggregate nature of his data, you know, is probably why one of the reasons he used it as a macro term. But for me, again, you're right. I think, you know, it makes a lot more sense to me at the social psychological level, because again, Durkheim, he believed that, you know, human wants are boundless and insatiable, right? You know, that was one of the things that he talked about, and that unless people are restrained, then there's, you know, then they represent a constant threat to their individual happiness. So he's using these things about individual happiness and, you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's kind of how I take it and how I've used the concept in my own research. Again, it's debatable, I would say.
You do a very good job really rooting this at the individual level, and reading through your book, you see how this is really applicable. And so let me ask you a little bit about that. What kind of specific evidence of social anime do you see here at work in the NFL? And I'm really interested in what you're doing, first and foremost, in your qualitative interviews when you're talking to these guys. So, you know, perhaps take me through one of these interview processes, and how does the interview take place, and how is social anime revealed? How do you know that that's going on?
Well, usually, you know, I wouldn't interview a player until I had spent some significant time with them, you know, again, trying to build the relationship with those guys. I mean, there were a few times that it happened quicker than I would have liked it to, just based on time constraints and you know all the things you got to go to when you're trying to finish a dissertation, right?
Right.
but by and large, you know, I really did try to spend a lot of time, even if it was just time on the phone and corresponding through email and all kinds of different ways, you know. And a lot of times, my interviews were very, very informal. You know, they were more like informal conversations. They knew that I was interviewing them, but we did it much more conversationally, just to try to get at the authentic, kind of nature of what it is they felt and what they were, you know, how they perceived their own lives and their lives within the NFL. And so a lot of times I just start out asking them things like, you know, tell me about yourself. Tell me about where you grew up. You know, tell me about your mom and dad. Tell me about, you know, where you went to school. You know, tell me about college football. Mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of things. And then we would just, you know, it would begin to just carry on. And I would get into more specific questions as we moved through. But I was typically trying to get at what changes have happened in your life, right? You know, how do you perceive the changes that have occurred in your life? You know, how did you perceive the change from high school to college? You know, how did you feel? You know, what happened? You know, and then more specifically, we really went into the changes between college and the NFL. So you either graduate from college and then you go to the combine, or you become a free agent, or, you know, and then you're drafted, whatever the sequence of events might have been. Or you were a player that left college early, you know, and then you went to the combines and on to the NFL. What was the process of that? Because that's a pretty stressful time for these guys. You know, they have to make a decision whether or not they're going to make themselves eligible for the draft, especially if they're underclassmen, you know, they're not seniors. So they've got that to deal with. Then they got to go to the combine, which is basically a meat market. You know, those guys stand up there with nothing but their underwear, and everybody goes up to them and touches them and says, "Ooh, ah." You know, it's basically in my interpretation, it's, you know, almost a modern day form of slavery. You know, these guys are put up there, most of them African American guys. 60-some-odd% of my group were African American guys from relatively poor backgrounds, who were doing this because that's what they've been told their whole life is the only thing that they can do.
Yeah, for those folks not familiar with the combine, what it basically is a combination of a number of NFL teams come together at one specific location, and these guys have to perform. They have to run fast, they have to jump high, they have to throw far, catch footballs, and then again, they go through medical exams and all that kind of stuff. So it is, you know, they're putting themselves on display for purchase, essentially, by some of these teams.
Right, you know, and just, again, it's just all these different things that are happening so fast in their lives. So they're constantly going through change, and from a more psychological perspective as well, that they know, particularly now, again, like I said earlier, since the age of free agency, that they're probably not going to play for the same team for very long.
Yeah.
These guys, you know, one week they could be in San Francisco, and the next week they're in Minnesota. You know, so it's a life of constant change. And so those were the things that I was trying to get at in the interviews. You know, so tell me about, you know, the times in which you felt like, you know, your life was thrown out of kilter a little bit. You know, how are you feeling? You know, what was going on with your family, with your friends, with your organization? You know, how did you feel like that the organization treated you?
And give us some examples. Go ahead and give us some examples of that without using names or anything. What were some of the stories that you heard?
Well, there was multiple, and in my book I give a couple examples, and I call them ideal, typical, kind of situations, anomic situations, or deviant situations of deviance, and call them ideal, typical, obviously because there were so many of them that were the same. You know, here were 100 guys, and a lot of those guys had the same story. I mean, it was really amazing. I that's something that I just never expected. You know, I thought, you know, there's a diversity of folks here. You know, I've got 100 guys that I'm dealing with, but you know, a majority of their stories were very, very similar. And so one of the ones that always stuck out in my mind that I've just never forgotten is, you know, I met a player at a hotel, and and I was with one of my informants. You know, this was earlier on, and so anytime I did an interview, typically that was more formal, I would take one of my informants with me. And again, when I say informant, I'm talking about one of my friends who was a former player in the league.
He's kind of a person that's going to make the introduction and such. Yeah, informant. Maybe for the people out there, it sounds too much like a spy novel or something like that. But it's a gatekeeper, somebody who can really get you, you know, to the subject that you're interested in, and you know, basically pave the way for the interview.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they were the gatekeepers. Without them, I don't get through. You know, it was, you know, and I can't say enough about their help, because without those two guys, none of this is possible. You know, they really laid the groundwork for me to get in, and especially for these guys like the one I'm about to talk about to take me seriously. You know, because again, I can't. And you mentioned this at the very beginning, but I can't state enough about how hard it is to get in and actually ask solid questions, good questions to these guys, because they are so on the defensive. And it's not just them. You've got to get through agents. You've got to get through hangers-on. You've got to get through family. You've got to get through folks in the organization. So it's an extremely hard thing just to get through to be able to ask good questions. So that's why having an informant or a gatekeeper is so important to get this kind of data. But back to this guy who really stuck out in my mind in terms of kind of an ideal, typical kind of form of deviance or situation of deviance in anime is, you know, I met him with my informant at a hotel, and we began to talk. And you know, I began to ask the same questions about, tell me about, you know, the things that have changed in your life. And he immediately went into talking about just how unhappy he was, you know, and how he was just striving for more and more stuff, you know, that he was never satisfied with. Mm-hmm. He could never sleep with enough women. He could never buy enough cars. He could never buy enough property. He was constantly, you know, running towards and forward and trying to accumulate more things in search for some kind of stability, in search for something that would give him a sense of purpose, something that would make him feel good about himself. This was a guy who was very, very successful. He was, you know, probably the best player at his position for a number of years. Very, very successful guy who won a lot of games. Quite frankly, one of the most gifted athletes to play, in my opinion. But he made more money at that time in his career than any other players at that particular position. So he was a very successful guy on the field, but he was one of the most unhappy guys I had ever met in my life. You know, and he attributed all this to kind of how his life had shifted after he'd gone to the NFL. And he said, you know, not that everything was fine and dandy and roses before that, but he said, I just simply didn't know how to deal with what I got. I didn't know how to deal with being famous. I didn't know how to deal with having money. I didn't know how to deal with having hangers-on. I didn't know how to deal with my family who wanted things from me. You know, I didn't know how to deal with my peers who wanted things from me, friends from back home. You know, all those are major stressors for these guys who are looked at to kind of go back home and take care of the community, or go back home and take care of the family,
right,
financially. You know, and he just said, you know, he was constantly after more and more to try to fulfill this hole in his life, you know, that came from in his words, from kind of the changes that had happened, and him not knowing how to cope with those changes. You know, he said he was just always striving to reach a goal, but he could never get there. You know, he got richer and richer and more famous, but as that happened, he became more miserable and more miserable. At the end of the day, this particular athlete tried to commit suicide. He attempted suicide. Luckily, he was unsuccessful, you know, and he's still around today, but he got to such a low point that, you know, it was hard for him to deal with just living, you know, and that, you know, going back to some of the things you said earlier, you know, how does that happen, you know, because we all say, you know, I'd like to take a shot at that, you know.
it must be really disorienting, because you all of a sudden became you become famous, you get a lot of money, and then all of a sudden people, as you mentioned, the hangers-on, and this is something I hadn't thought about before, is that all of a sudden people want stuff from you, and you don't know who they are, and you don't know if they want stuff from you because they like you, or if they want stuff because you have stuff and stuff that they want. And so that's got to be make you really kind of question what the relationships of people around you happen to be.
Right, and that's a really hard thing for these guys to negotiate, our relationships. And one of the really interesting things that I found was how few good relationships they have with people. Because they're very they don't trust a whole lot of people, even their teammates. Again, because in the age of free agency, they could be playing with a guy 1 week and then trying to hit him the next week on the field. So they're not. There's not a whole lot of really solid relationships for these guys. I've seen a number and talked to a number of these players and folks who are close to these players, and they would say, so-and-so doesn't have a real friend in the world. And you're thinking, man, that has got to be hard to deal with. Here are famous folks. They have everything they need, everything they want, but they don't have any friends.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not true for all, but there is a significant number of these guys who have a lot of acquaintances, but they don't have a lot of friends.
Well, let me talk about that issue, and it gets into this issue of coping mechanisms of how you deal with this, and really gets us to the heart of what our podcast is all about, is religion and how that plays an impact in people's lives. What are some of the coping mechanisms that you found for some of these guys? Now, as you mentioned, you interviewed 100 plus guys or so. Not all of them had deep problems. Some of them did have some decent ways to deal with this. So what'd you find there?
Well, yeah, there was, over half of the guys, had fairly solid backgrounds and support systems and were pretty successful and able to cope with their fame and fortune and that kind of thing. Difficult times, obviously, throughout, but somehow we're able to stay out of major trouble. And I think some of the interesting things, or some of the important things that I found, were in terms of the guys that had really solid support in some shape, form, or fashion. Right. So the guys that actually graduated from college instead of leaving for the pros early were much more likely to be successful and be able to cope with kind of those endemic circumstances that they were thrown into. And I think, at least according to those guys in interviews and conversations with them, they attributed a lot of that to, spending a lot of time at that university with a coaching staff and developing relationships there, mm-hmm. Where there was a solid foundation, where they could identify with their alma mater, where they could, they had a long-lasting relationship with some of the players from their intercollegiate days, from some of the coaching staff that was there, and that carried them through. They were able, when they had problems, to call those guys and say, hey, I'm going through this. What do you suggest? Can I come and see you? Can I come down to the game this weekend?
Yeah.
Can we talk? And those guys seem to do much better. So the educational background seemed to be a very, very important thing. And also, of course, just the fact that they were also able to develop relationships with professors.
Mm-hmm.
They got their degree. They were invested in that institution, right? It was a part of who they were. So that was a really important thing for those guys. And the guys that didn't have that, there was another support mechanism that typically wasn't as available to them. Think about some of the more recent cases, the Reggie Bush case, and a lot of times these guys take off and there's all this kind of turmoil that gets in the way of them and their institution, and it's no longer a place for support. So that was one thing, one institution that I found was very, very important.
Let me ask about that, the educational institution. Do you think that was really effective of the institution, or was it the fact that some of these guys had other support networks behind them that prompted them to make those relationships with the coaching staff or stick through the 4 years of college? I know at University of Washington here we have a quarterback who many people were saying, oh, should go to the pros early, go early, and he made the decision to last 4 years. And is it the institution that you find prompting this, or was it the family background, or what do you think is going on there?
Well, certainly the family background. That was another one that I was going to mention.
Yeah.
Certainly that plays a role as well, because a lot of the times the guys that end up graduating have been pushed, and that's been something that's been emphasized as an important component for them and for their families. So that certainly was important. But I think there was a lot of guys that didn't have that and who through sticking around in college, that was kind of the last institutional support place.
Yeah.
That was going to have an impact on them before they became professionals. So it was kind of the last-ditch effort, if you will, in terms of an institutional support mechanism. And so even without the family, I think it for some of them, it was important. I think you're right, though, that it's much deeper and complex than just simply the institution of education as a place for support for these guys, because the family was very important. However, you know, there was a pretty big proportion of these players that grew up, you know, with not many family ties. You know, sure, they had a mother or a grandmother or whatever that cared for them and did all they could, but they just didn't have a solid family background, something that, you know, that gave them a lot of support. And, you know, and again, this is just some, it's not all of the guys, I don't want to overgeneralize, but, you know, those were certainly cases. You know, and I think that was important as well. And also I think the peer relationships that they developed in college, also a lot of them mentioned as more positive than the peer relationships that they developed in the pros. So those seem to be longer lasting and more influential in helping those guys stay grounded.
What about the role of religion? I mean, that's one of our you know, main themes here. And what role does religious faith play here in helping some of these guys get through this thing? And, you know, I guess maybe in a little bit we can talk about to what extent do some of these people who find problems then find God. So let's start with the first one. What about the religious upbringing?
Well, I mean, at first it wasn't, you know, even for my book necessarily, I don't talk a whole lot about the religious factor per se. This is something that I've begun to explore here lately through conversations with some of my colleagues and that kind of thing, really looking at that, because I hadn't looked at that variable very specifically. I had used it previously as just one component of a social support index.
Right.
Right. But when going back and really looking at that variable, I was thinking, man, I should have played that up a little bit more, mm-hmm. because I didn't realize how important it was to these 104 guys, or to a majority of these 104 guys. It really did act as kind of a social bond for a lot of players. And I think what was going on is, you know, you get a lot of these guys, again, who come from, who are family or close relationship deprived, right? They don't have a lot of close relationships, and so they're looking for kind of substitute social bonds and support. And so religion offered them this, and it was something that was a constant for them. It was something that was always there. It was something they could confide in. It was something that, you know, would furnish these guys with some kind of companionship. It would furnish them with a sense of belonging. You know, so many of the guys that I interviewed who kind of really showed gnomic characteristics were guys who said, I don't have a sense of purpose. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I should be doing. You know, my life is just up in the air constantly, you know. And so those guys that really were involved in some kind of religious participation particularly seemed to find that sense of belonging. They seemed to find kind of emotional, social, psychological, and social supports that were missing in their lives previously. So it really became an important factor to help them stay grounded. You know, and what I found was of the guys that reported who told me that they were, you know, they were actually happy, You know, again, because one of the really intriguing findings of this study was that about half of the guys, half of these 104 guys, that actually admitted that they were unhappy people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other half that said that they were happy, that reported being happy with life, religion was a huge component of those guys' happiness, you know, in terms of what they told me. So it actually was important as kind of a support mechanism in their lives. You know, and again, the other thing that I would note too is that it wasn't just simply the guys who, you know, scored the touchdown and, you know, stuck their finger in the air, you know,
right.
And you know, at the post game interview, you know, I want to give all my thanks to God, et cetera, et cetera. It was the guys that participated religiously,
right.
You know, that they were involved in the community, they were involved in some kind of through some kind of religious organization. You know, those guys seem to be the happiest and most well-grounded players out of the whole study, and I was very surprised that actually played out that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume a lot of these players brought that through their college careers and into the professional ranks. You know, I'm thinking like of a Tim Tebow, who really grew up in a religious household. His dad was a missionary, and he went on various missions at times. So a lot of players bring that to them. Did you find any evidence of people who experience this anime and exhibit these animic characteristics who then look for something else and then find religion and are able to turn their lives around?
Yeah, absolutely. There were several who had wonderful stories of, you know, being kind of at the depths, you know, and really, you know, at the total bottom of the barrel, you know, whether it be drug and alcohol abuse, a lot of pain medication that's abused, a lot of alcoholism, divorce, you know, those kinds of things that just, you know, tend to throw people into the depths, and you know, and they found, you know, support through religion, through a church, through a religious organization, through some kind of service through religion, and really did turn their lives around. I mean, the religious factor, according to a number of these 104 guys, saved their lives.
Yeah.
It really did. You know, they're not shy or bashful to admit the impact of that factor in their lives, and they are very sincere about it. You know, those are the guys that aren't in the, you know, the post game interview. Not all of them. I mean, somebody like Kurt Warner, for example, who by the way I did not interview, but he's a guy who I heard about, who players talked about, who, you know, who was a very authentic person. You know, he's mm-hmm. the guy that comes to mind who would, you know, give thanks to God after the game, and actually live that. But a lot of guys that did that weren't always on the same page. You know, so it was the guys that who were living that in their daily lives and found that that, you know, began to do a little bit better, began to be able to buffer kind of, you know, the religious factor was kind of a buffer against the anime that they were all experiencing. You know, it was a very meaningful buffer. You know, again, it gave them a sense of purpose. So it kind of played, it was in the middle between anime and deviance, because again, most of these guys experienced anomic conditions. It was the guys that had something in the middle that prevented them from, you know, kind of going into deviant activities, whatever that deviance might be.
Did you find any influence of religious colleges? And I'm thinking of like a Notre Dame or a Boston College that have a strong religious tradition here. And a lot of these religious schools have chaplains that are there in the locker room, as compared to a major state university where that would, you know, cause a great deal of controversy to have that. Did any of these players, or, you know, maybe you don't know this, but does, for some of these guys that didn't have that base, did going to a religious college have an impact in their lives?
You know, I didn't know. I mean, all the guys that I interviewed, I mean, I knew where they went to college, and so there were a number of guys that went to colleges, at least briefly, you know, some of them as transfers or what have you, to colleges with religious orientations, like Notre Dame, for example. But in the findings and in the conversations with those guys, that did not seem to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the thing that seemed to make a difference was that if they stayed there for 4 or 5 years, if they actually got their degree from there, it wasn't necessarily that the college had an impact on them religiously. Again, because a lot of these guys, you know, a lot of these guys played for a couple different colleges. They started out
junior
in
college,
then went into another university, and so, you know, they didn't spend all 4 years at one particular institution. So that could perhaps be part of it, but I didn't find that. I don't know that that's not the case, because this is, again, you know, only 100 guys, basically.
Yeah.
You know, but it could very well have an impact, but I didn't see it in my research.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, again, part of what we do here on Research on Religion is not only look for answers, but we look for, you know, new avenues to explore, new questions to investigate and such. So maybe, you know, you pursue that, or other budding graduate students out here who are inspired by what you've been doing can pick that up. Let me also ask you, so I talked about religious colleges here having an influence, but a few minutes ago you mentioned somebody like Kurt Warner, that people look up to him. They saw him as very authentic, and he becomes a role model maybe for some of the guys in the locker room there. Do you see any of that, or did you hear any of that, that somebody who's really troubled, you know, looks over at their teammate down a few lockers, and they seem to be living the religious authentic life, and this rubs off on them, or it helps them through that? And again, this is put into the context of free agency, where, you know, relationships are somewhat fragile, you know, throughout the course of a year, or course of several years. So what can you say about that?
I think that there were situations and players that had a great impact on other teammates. Again, like you said, though, with the nature of the game now, those are fewer and far between, because they're just simply not around the same group of guys on a year in, year out basis. But I did see that. I mean, I think one of the important things that I found in conversations with those guys was that veteran players who were solid, who had support, who were very much invested in the organization and in a religious organization as well, and were very well respected, did have an impact on younger guys. The younger guys looked up to those guys, and they were able to, you know, kind of help them along to a certain degree. And if this were, you know, 30 years ago in the NFL, you know, my guess is that would be a much more successful process. The problem is again, they're just not around the same group of guys constantly, so it's always changing. But you know, somebody like Kurt Warner, I think, you know, has had a great deal of effect on certain players. Another guy that I didn't interview, who I've heard people talk about, who had a lot of impact on players, was a guy named Chris Carter,
mm-hmm.
Who was a wide receiver for the Vikings. I heard folks talk about, you know, the impact that he had had on younger guys, the positive impacts that he had had. So I think that was definitely there, you know, and those guys who were outspoken religiously, you know, said, you know, this is an important support for you. This can help you through. You know, this is important. The spirituality, the social support of the organization, the service aspect. You know, those were important, and it was the guys that said, hey, we're going to give something back, you know, those guys were the happiest, you know, the guys that were giving something back. And it wasn't just the guys who were doing the you know, their standard United Way commercial.
Right.
You know, it was the guys who were actually giving back, you know, were very, very grounded and pretty happy guys for the most part.
It seems that some of these guys that people have to look up to, you mentioned Chris Carter and Kurt Warner, they have to have shown that degree of success, though, because, you know, I'm thinking now of Tim Tebow, his rookie year in the NFL. I just kind of wonder if anybody laughs at him when he comes in. Oh, here's the, you know, the missionary guy who stuck through 4 years of Florida. Let's see how well you do. They might not garner as much respect as somebody, Kurt Warner, who, you know, can hold up his fingers and say, hey, there's a Super Bowl ring here.
Right. Yeah, again, I think, you know, what I was, you know, the important part of what I was saying, I think, earlier is that they were veterans, you know, that they seemed, they're guys who had been around the block, even guys who had, you know, had problems to a certain degree at one point in their life and had been able to correct those. You know, but it's an interesting thing because, you know, one of the things that I just thought about, too, that the language that a lot of players used around kind of religion and guys who are religious or Christians in the locker room, they talked about the haves and the have-nots. You know, and so the haves were the guys who were devoutly Christian, and the have-nots were the guys who were very antagonistic to those guys. And then there was a group in the middle, and those were usually the younger guys who came in and who were trying to figure out which direction to go.
Yeah.
You know, so but you know that there was a bit of competitiveness and antagonism between those groups. There was kind of a power struggle, you know, in the locker room between the haves and the have-nots, at least according to a number of players that I talked to. You know, so they recognized that, and so somebody like Tim Tebow, for example, is probably, and I don't know this, but I'm making an assumption, is probably not going to, based on my information, is basically not going to have as much of an impact as a rookie. Now, if he sticks around and is successful, you know, he may be able to do some good in the league and kind of help get folks supported and, you know, as he matures in the league and that kind of thing. So, you know, but the haves and the have-nots, that was, you know, kind of how a lot of players kind of termed, you know, those who were devout Christians versus those who weren't.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we're running short on time here, and your book, Boys Gone Wild, is a great study and insight into this world of professional sports, and as you mentioned, your research is still progressing in terms of how religion impacts this, so we're going to, you know, keep you on the radar screen here, maybe have you back in a little bit to discuss more findings that you have. But I can't resist here. I mean, we're talking about the NFL, and we've had some very serious conversations about this. But again, you know, as you say, this is a lighthearted entertainment industry that, you know, sometimes we take too seriously, and including myself. So here's the tough question. We're recording this at the end of December in 2010. We're about a week away from the playoffs and figuring out the playoff picture. So Eric, who's going to the Super Bowl this year?
Who's going to the Super Bowl?
Yeah, this will be a good test. See your social science acumen here of who's gonna be there.
Well, you know, I thought the Jets were going to make a run at it, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
The Patriots just look too strong.
Oh, they are really peaking right now. It might be a repeat of that Super Bowl that you went to earlier. The, you know, Eagles and the Patriots.
You know, it very well could be. You know, the Eagles are looking extremely strong. I mean, Michael Vick has made an amazing comeback.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, speaking of deviance,
yeah.
You know, he's done a lot. From what I've heard from other players, he's done some really great things lately. So I hope his luck continues, and I'll be rooting for him for sure.
That's good to hear.
And the Tom Brady and the Patriots look awful tough right now.
Well, they do. I think they're the odds-on favorite here. I'm actually looking at the Patriots and Bears. So what are you thinking?
Yeah, the Bears could make a run. They've had some up and down games, even though they've already won their division. I have a hard time thinking they're going to make it all the way through the playoffs.
Yeah, I've watched the last couple games. They seem to be peaking pretty good, but you're right. My Seattle Seahawks actually ended up beating them in Chicago, so that can't bode very well for them. So.
Right.
Well, we'll see how it all plays out here, and we'll be sure to stay in touch with you. And for those of you listening, I strongly suggest you pick up the book, Boys Gone Wild. We'll link to it up on our website. And Eric, it's been great having you on Research on Religion.
Great. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.